Welcome to the New Books Network and the African Studies podcast, part of a continuing series of podcasts on books, not only on Africa, but on a host of other topics. My name is Jim Lance, and I am very pleased today to have as my guest Professor Michelle Moyd, Associate Professor of History at Indiana University in Bloomington. We'll be talking about her book, Violent Intermediaries, African Soldiers, Conquest, and Everyday Colonialism in German East Africa. It's published by Ohio University Press in 2014, and it's part of the New African History series with the academic editors Gene Allman, Alan Isaacman, and Derek Peterson. If I may, I'd just like to read a bit about from the back cover about Michelle's book. I was struck by Jamie Munson's comment in her blurb. Jamie says, Michelle Moyd offers a uniquely empathetic reading of colonial sources and a new narrative voice as she uncovers the histories of actors that have been mythologized, misused, and misunderstood for more than a century. And these actors are the Askari, A-S-K-R-I, a key Swahili word, African soldiers recruited in the 1890s to fill the ranks of the German East African colonial army. Lauded by the Germans for their loyalty during the East Africa campaign of World War I, they were reviled by Tanzanians for the violence they committed during the making of the colonial state between 1890 and 1918. Violent Intermediaries situates these Askari in their everyday household, community, military, and constabulary roles as men who helped make colonialism in German East Africa. By linking microhistories with wider 19th century African historical processes, Professor Moyd shows how the Askari, as soldiers and colonial intermediaries, built the colonial state while simultaneously carving out paths to respectability, becoming men of influence within their local contexts. Through its focus on the making of empire from the ground up, Violent Intermediaries offers a fresh perspective on African colonial troops as state-making agents and critiques the mythologies surrounding the Askari by focusing on the nature of colonial violence. Welcome to the program, Michelle. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
I always like to find out what makes African historians tick, how they became interested in studying Africa, and how they focused on a particular topic as an expression of their interest. So could you just tell me a bit about yourself, about your background, and why you decided to focus on the Askari and German East Africa?
Sure. There are several ways I could answer this. I think probably the most immediate is the biographical detail that I'm African American. My father's African American, and he was in the Air Force for almost 30 years. So I grew up in military environments, and I also grew up keenly aware of being African American. My father insisted at a very early age that I learn the history of black people in the United States. So I think I always kind of had a sense of the importance of understanding where people came from and how societies shape them in that way. Later on, I myself joined the Air Force, and I too sort of participated in this this culture of violence in a way, obviously very differently than what is conveyed in this book. But I came to really question my position in the military as an African American person, and in the process of my career in the Air Force, I had an opportunity to teach at the Air Force Academy, and as preparation for that job, the Air Force paid for me to get a master's degree at the University of Florida in the mid-90s, and that was when I first undertook an academic or an intellectual project of trying to understand African history. And then in the course of actually teaching at the Air Force Academy and coming to reaching the conclusion that that this East African campaign of World War One was a really great kind of way to reflect on the position of black soldiers in a white army. I decided that I really wanted to pursue that as a project over the long haul. So I left the Air Force and started a PhD at Cornell, and that's what I've been doing for the last 15 years, more or less, is tracing the history of these black soldiers who fought in a white army. And really, I think the question that has informed my research all along is how we understand these men as men, and what motivated them, and what made them tick, and also what it says, what their history tells us about the ways that that militaries use certain demographics to fill out their ranks and to help them conduct their operations, however construed. So that's sort of the long answer to a short question.
Well, it's a great answer because I've often encountered people in conversation when people ask, why are you studying Africa? It's so exotic. And I said, no, there are many linkages between what happened in the African past and our own. And I think your answer just amplifies why this book is really about so much more than this relatively narrow period of time and relatively small group of people. You deal with some major themes, and you've sort of articulated them in your answer to my opening question. You deal with issues of masculinity, you deal with issues of patronage and power, and you deal with issues of the relationship of the military to the construction of the colonial state. And also, I think laterally, I was communicating with you earlier about the relationship of the military, the U.S. military in particular, in relation to nation building. But I think you also raised the larger question, which you address at the end of your book, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that, the question of why people work for organizations such as the state or the colonial state that employ violence and coercion in ways that often mitigate against the best interests of the people involved. So I think your book really can be amplified much more into areas much greater than at first blush would appear when we read your book.
Okay. Glad to hear that.
And also I was struck why I read Jamie Munson's comment and her description of the empathetic reading you make in your study. One thing that really struck me about the book was your creative use of sources and how you went about reconstructing what you call in your book Askari realities. And in reading the book, it seems to me that the Askari, particularly those who served during the German period of occupation, fit the maxim, old soldiers never die, they simply fade away. Mm-hmm. So what kinds of sources did you use? What kinds of silences did you encounter? And how did you go about trying to overcome the gaps and omissions and silences in the story of the Askari?
Well, I'll start with your second sort of point there about silences. The biggest silence, quite obviously, is that we have almost no sources that give us direct, or as direct as a historian can get, access to the voices of these men themselves. There really isn't much, and so that necessitates using the sources that are available, which are quite abundant actually. There are the memoirs of colonial officers and administrators. There are archival documents that that were generated by the colonial government in various capacities. There are war diaries. There are missionary reports and documents, published memoirs, as well as unpublished archival diaries and letters and such that are housed in archives. There's a lot of photography, actually, which has been useful in certain ways, but also present certain problems that I can elaborate on if you want.
Well, yeah, I loved your description. Unfortunately, this isn't a visual program, right. But your description of the cover, mm-hmm. and sort of the messages and symbolism of the cover. Yeah, and your book is profusely illustrated for an academic book. I think Ohio did a pretty good job with that. Mm-hmm. But they also kind of reminded me of the photographs of Edward Curtis and of Native Americans and how he mythologized and kind of created this image of the loyal, noble, mm-hmm. savage, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? The photography is really useful in as much as it gives us some visual evidence of certain scenarios and settings, but we also have to be very cognizant, obviously, of how the photos were produced. You know, keeping in mind that technologies were quite different then. Photography, it took a long time for, obviously I'm not an expert photographer, but, you know, it took a long time to actually produce a photo in those 100 years ago. And that meant that probably most of the scenes that we see in the photographs that are available were staged in a way. But that doesn't mean that they're utterly useless. It just means we have to be very critical of how we read them and take what information we can from them, but also use them to tell a story about representation and what purposes that served, what purposes those representations served for the people who produced them. But you know, it's definitely a difficult kind of source to use. And in my book, I really wanted to stay away from the what I think is a sometimes problematic usage of photography in historical texts, where they're used to kind of demonstrate, they're used to illustrate a point, but they're not. There's no critical reading of them embedded in the text. So I tried to do a little bit of that in the book, and I'm certain I could have done more. But anyway, so what else? There are newspapers, lots of colonial newspapers that were generated by colonial organizations, both in Germany and in the colony. And then, let's see, what else? There are also British perspectives that I used, tried to incorporate. So especially during World War One, there's a lot of primary source material that was generated by the British Army that was operating in East Africa. So I went to the National Archives in Kew in London to look at those. And those are quite helpful in giving kind of an outsider perspective on the German army as they were operating in the field. So I tried to attack the problem from, you know, using as much material as I could to try and recreate a portrait from all of these fragments of material that I had.
Yeah, I see. I think at one point, if I remember correctly, you talked about reading these sources against the grain. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to kind of nudge you a bit more into explaining that a bit to me, because when I was doing my graduate training, it was the heyday of, and this is aging me, of nationalist historiography, uh-huh. where people such as the Ascari were seen as little more than collaborators and mercenaries, and we were all looking for resistance, yeah. to the state. And these people were not the locus of resistance.
Yeah.
But so I'm interested in sort of like how you read against the grain, and maybe we can just use a concept that's in your title, the concept of intermediary, as a way of showing how your approach differs from certainly the nationalist perspective, and how your approach differs in what kinds of contributions this approach makes to our understanding what really is a much more nuanced and nuanced and fluid situation than was sort of apparent when I was doing my training.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point and one that I was keenly interested in investigating. And I spent a lot of time in my early dissertation writing phases trying to figure out the best way to go about it. So, the problem with the nationalist, well, let me say, the nationalist historiography existed for a reason, and that was because, you know, new African nation states needed and wanted a history that would reflect their positions as, as members of the, global community, as nation states, and that would also give them a narrative upon which to, to move forward into the independence era. And so the nationalist historiographies tended to celebrate, particular kinds of past moments. So in Tanzania in particular, the touchstone nationalist moment was the Maji Maji Rebellion of 1905 to 1907, in which, something like a third of the territory of Tanzania was perceived by the Germans to be in rebellion against the colonial authority. And the nationalist historiography really made the case for understanding that moment as a proto-national moment. And they used, it used oral histories that were collected by University of Dar es Salaam students and historians of that generation assembled that data into a narrative that really served the purposes of the new state. And of course, as a part of that, as you rightly mentioned, the Askari were cast as collaborators, as mercenaries, as brutes, as people who were firmly on the wrong side of history in terms of the Tanzanian resistance narrative, which, of course, was celebrating the rebels and the people who fought against colonialism. There was really no place for the Askari in that narrative except for as people who served the colonial state with great violence and selfishly so, right? I get that. I completely understand why that had to happen in that way. But it didn't fit with my own sort of understanding of why soldiers sign up to serve in armies, or why they end up becoming parts of armies, and the kind of simple violence narrative that was applied to them, that they were violent for the sake of being violent, also didn't make sense to me, because that would have kind of required that it was an army of sadists, or an army of people with deep psychological problems or something, and that too just didn't make sense to me. I mean, typically armies are built of very ordinary men and women, so I really wanted to challenge that construction, and it wasn't until quite late in my dissertation process that the literature on intermediaries really kind of became available. And that was really the hook that I needed. And so I'm, of course, very grateful to the scholars who did that research and brought the concept into conversation among Africanists. Intermediaries being people who kind of helped facilitate the placement or the emplacement of the state into the Tanzanian landscape, the colonial state into the Tanzanian political landscape, who through their everyday activities. And this is not to say that everyone loved the Askari and that they facilitated lots of social mobility for people in some kind of positive way. That's not the point I want to make. The point I want to make is that the Askari became people who helped the colonial state to entrench itself in particular ways. Some Askari intermarried with women from, if not local populations, then at least East African populations that sort of created ties across longer distances than one would have thought. Askari were also extremely visible in terms of their mobility. They, even though there weren't that many of them, they were constantly moving. They were delivering messages, and they were escorting colonial administrators. They were doing patrols. They were doing, expeditions. So they were visible to, and because they were uniformed, they were quite visible in the work that they did. So there's a way in which, even if they were not engaging people in a productive way, they were creating a kind of narrative about the colonial state that I argue helped to shape make visible or make apparent the possibility of being involved in a colonial modernity. I think that's kind of the crux of what I'm trying to say here. It's not that people saw the Askari and thought, I really want to be like them, or, I really want to, I want to be part of the Askari community. Certainly that was part of it for some people, but it's more about the idea of them as agents of colonialism and kind of their ability to disperse that vision across a wide terrain, making the idea of a colonial state visible to many East Africans.
Well, certainly, in my opinion, you effectively refute the notion of these people being pathological criminals seeking their own self-interest and just enjoying sadistically violence for their own sake. But I'd like to move on to how you look at the Askari, because another thing I really liked about the book is you can almost smell the dust and feel the sweat of Askari life, the everyday life, as you call it, the everyday processes of everyday colonialism. So my question now is, let's talk a bit about the Askari themselves. Why did Africans choose to become Askari, and how does this relate to a notion you emphasize throughout the book of the big man?
Well, I think that the first thing that needs to be said is that, and this is something that took me quite a long time to realize, is that the notion of choice and kind of voluntarism in becoming Askari has to be qualified, in as much as it was an era in which a number of parts of the African continent were undergoing massive upheaval in terms of warfare, the building of standing armies and state building processes that were massively disruptive to populations across the continent. And the two that I sort of focus on in the first chapter of the book are what is today Sudan, the nation state of Sudan, and then of course Tanzania. And what I try to show is that there were processes underway in both of those regions that made soldiering an option that was appealing perhaps to some, but also the only viable option for many young men to make a living that would lead to a kind of respectability or big man status, as I refer to it in the book. It was a time in which, there were colonial encroachments, the shutting down of older ways of becoming respectable, the diversion of men into migrant labor economies, and it's not that there weren't possibilities for making a living, but the possibilities for making a living and achieving the kind of status that would allow men to become patrons themselves were shrinking. And so what I argue is that the men who ended up becoming colonial soldiers, and specifically German colonial soldiers, were men who probably had some kind of past or origins in places where soldiering was known to be was a known possibility for achieving, for making a living and achieving a kind of respectability. And so in a way, service in the Schutztruppe kind of self-selected men who found that it made sense in their sort of life trajectory, if that makes sense.
Sure does.
I should say, in fact, you know, I started with the idea that we have to question the idea of voluntarism. The most striking example of that is that many of the soldiers who came from Sudan probably had backgrounds as slave soldiers. And what I mean by that is that they were probably captured as young men by any number of slaving agents who were operating in the region in the mid 19th century. And those boys and young men then more or less grew up in militaries. They grew up experiencing warfare. They started out as kind of apprentices to other soldiers and then became soldiers themselves and moved up the ranks and perpetuated and reproduced that process over the decades. So the notion that they were volunteers is not quite right. But it is, I think we can make the case that for some men like them, the military appeared to be the only option available for a viable kind of, for making a living in a viable way.
Right. You implied in your answer just now something that really also struck me about your book was sort of the linkages between pre-colonial militarization, and you mentioned Sudanese. The people labeled as Sudanese often had a belligerent or background or a history of being slave warriors, and linkages between that, the pre-colonial military cultures, and those that evolved under German occupation. You also talk about how these linkages relate to what you call the Askari way of war. Could you talk a little bit about that concept and how the Askari were trained and socialized into a new but not terribly, but maybe perhaps not totally unfamiliar military life and culture?
Yeah. So the Askari way of war that I describe is involves certain kinds of practices that I think clearly link to a pre-colonial past, and probably could be found in other contexts as well if we looked closely. So one is the idea that when you fight, women and children are fair game as part of the spoils of war, that women and children can be captured and taken along on these long expeditionary operations, and then, in fact, incorporated into soldiers' households. So that, in fact, what they were doing in the course of warfare was potentially increasing their domestic wealth, their wealth in people. And that is something that you can see in descriptions of warfare in the first part of the 19th century for sure, in contexts that range from southern Africa all the way up to northeastern Africa. Those are the so I haven't looked as closely at Western Africa. I suspect you would find similar patterns, but those are the sort of broad regional context that I've looked at in a comparative way. Another is the idea of the raid, the raid in which you don't you don't engage an enemy directly on a battlefield in some kind of Napoleonic way or, you know, in a sort of the image that we have of traditional military history as confrontation between two, you know, well-equipped and organized armies. That's not so much what the Askari were doing. Instead, they were practicing a kind of warfare that had guerrilla elements to it. Certainly, they used concealment. They used small unit formations. They used surprise attacks. So the idea of the raid is another thing that I think looks more like pre-colonial African history than it does African military history than it does, say, what was going on in Europe in the 19th century. Although, of course, there are exceptions, like the Franc-Tireur the Franco-Prussian War would be an example of Europeans using a kind of guerrilla style warfare. So those are two examples of what I consider to be the Askari way of war. And what was really useful about it to the Schutztruppe, I think, is that they could use those elements of East African styles of warfare, incorporate them into their own practices in ways that were productive for them, of course, because it meant that they could confront their opponents more on their terms, more on in terms of how wars were fought in Eastern Africa. They could also ensure that they were meeting they were keeping their soldiers happy by allowing them to loot and to pillage and to seize people, right? So there's a way in which the conduct of warfare that the Askari brought with them the understanding of warfare that the Askari brought with them into the Schutztruppe served German purposes and probably taught them quite a bit about the nature of warfare in East Africa along the way.
Well, you've sort of led nicely into my next question relating to the Askari way of war, and that is about the training process. You've basically answered the question by showing or intimating ways that the training was different from the kinds of training that German rank and file soldiers receive in Europe. But in what ways was it similar? And in particular, in what ways did the treatment of the African soldiers differ? Was the treatment the same, but also different from the ways that, say, disciplined German soldiers were disciplined?
I think there are actually more similarities than differences, and this is something I haven't systematically looked at, but my sense is that the Germans had, over the course of the 19th century, had a history of brutalizing their soldiers, punishing them quite severely for all manner of infractions, and that they brought those kinds of expectations and modes of disciplining their soldiers with them to East Africa. So certainly, Askari who did not perform or who fell out of line with German expectations could anticipate receiving harsh punishments, which could, and in the worst case, include this kind of ritualistic flogging, which was known as the Hamsa Ishirini in Swahili, the 25, which was 25 lashes with a hide whip. It's quite a severe punishment. The Germans were not alone in this, by the way. The British also had a history of flogging their soldiers. But so there's that kind of carryover from the German context. And another very clear carryover is the emphasis on drill and ceremony that Askari were expected to participate in on more or less a daily basis. That, you know, they got up in the morning and they did parade drill, parade practice, and they practiced drilling. They did repetitive training exercises. They did target practice. And they also did war games, which was another German kind of innovation from earlier in the 19th century, where they would go out and actually perform some kind of scenario of a wartime situation, where soldiers were ostensibly practicing what they would do in a real combat situation. So there are all these ways in which, and soldiers actually were given commands in German. So there was a way in which, even though Askari were not known to be great German speakers, they, you know, some of them clearly did learn it, but it doesn't seem to have been an across the board kind of thing. They still were responding to German commands that were issued by their NCOs and officers. So it, in some ways, I've thought of it as an overlay onto African military practices that then created this kind of hybrid new way of war, or, you know, a training method that then that engaged both the German history of training soldiers, but that also had to be responsive to African soldiers' willingness to participate in that program.
Well, I will move on to later. I really would really hope we can talk about the really fascinating parts of your book that deal with theatricality and performance and these ritualized demonstrations of authority and power. But I can't let you go without discussing one more of your concepts,
okay.
The concept of everyday colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean, and what does it add to our understanding of colonialism writ large?
Well, I should say that the reason that I ended up using that concept was because partly because of the nature of my sources. As I mentioned right at the outset of our talk, I didn't have much that gave me direct access to the voices of the Askari, and so what that led me to do was to think about what the sources that I had, what they told me about the Askari. So one of the kinds of sources that I had very early on was like pay books and equipment lists which showed the kinds of equipment that Askari had been issued. And the Germans were quite meticulous at expecting their Askari to keep their equipment in order and also keeping track of what equipment they had. And so I got really interested in, I think it was a source that said something about, you know, Askari such and such has lost his boots, something like that, you know. And at first I thought, well, this doesn't help me much. You know, this is not very useful information. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that if I got enough of that kind of information, I might be able to make a case for understanding their sort of what was important to them, what they thought they were doing, what kinds of struggles developed between them and their officers. What were the kind of everyday artifacts that would help me understand them as people operating in this colonial environment. So the idea of everyday colonialism really kind of emerged out of that. And what I wanted to get at was the way that practices, you know, sort of the things that we think of as a given for soldiers and police, the patrols and the combat operations, the expeditions, the violence, really, how we could see those things as practice, and how we could then talk about practice as being the features of building a new state, a colonial state. So I was really, it was partly source driven, but I was also really interested in trying to understand the processes by which these Askari were engaged in constructing the colonial state, both through conquest, but also through their kind of, maybe we would think of it as their administrative tasks, you know, the carrying of messages and the escorting and policing type duties that really tax collection, involvement in tax collection, you know, all of these things that really, if there was a colonial state that we can talk about, they were the ones who made it function in a very practical kind of way. So that's what I meant by that concept, and using that concept helped direct my helped direct the way that I read the sources to really focus on aspects of mobility and how local circumstances influence particular outcomes, and to not take for granted any actions as being representative of one particular thing, but instead to think about these actions as being contextual and not being obvious, to really think about them as having their own kind of significance, and hopefully then putting all of that together to be able to tell a bigger story about the making of colonialism.
Well, that when we were talking earlier about illustrations, I'm thinking in particular in regard to your response just now, the illustration of the three African soldiers, two of whom are wearing boots, one is barefoot. They're all wearing fezes, but they're wearing them in different ways. One's wearing them in a rather jaunty way, another's kind of nonchalantly has it on the back of his head. And then you just kind of, something you just said about if there is a colonial state struck a chord with me, and not only in regard to that this photograph, which kind of shows the limitations of the state and how it wishes to be, how the Germans wish their state to be perceived, and that leads to your really, really fascinating discussion about theatricality and performance and ritual, which to me, I kind of felt that the overt physical violence, the raids and the attacks, really kind of paled in comparison to the ritualistic and performative aspects that the Askari did, showing what the state was, even if it really wasn't what it was.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Yes. I mean, that too was something that I spent a lot of time working up to being able to make the argument. And partly the reason it took me so long was because, again, there's a way in which, if you've been in the military, so all of this just feels very obvious, right? The parades, the drill, the customs and courtesies, you know, saluting and all of that stuff. There's a way in which it's taken for granted. But what I came to realize is that all of that was doing work for the colonial state, for the Germans, and it was projecting. It was projecting an image that they thought would help convince their colonial subjects, Africans who lived within the orbit of the stations where these Askari lived and worked, that these performances would convince them of the colonial state's power and permanence and kind of strength. So then in trying to imagine what those performances were doing, of course I run into the problem of not being able to really access the reception on the part of those who witnessed these performances. But I still think it's important to not, again, and this goes to the everyday colonialism thing, it's important not to accept that these performances were doing one thing or the other. The colonial state certainly thought it was doing something by having these big parades and by having their askari go through all of this ceremonial, all these ceremonial activities. That doesn't mean that that message was received by the by African populations in the way that they wanted. And it also doesn't take into account what the askari thought they were doing when they were involved in all of this stuff, right? So, in the end, it was trying to, again, question these kind of obvious manifestations of military authority and the things that militaries always do, and to really think about what meanings are involved in those activities.
Speaking of activities, your book also dispelled for me a notion of the askari and their participation in the colonial state. It's sort of the askari saw it as an arena for their expressions of their masculinity. But again, another part of your book really highlights the role that women played in the creation of soldiers, askari soldiers becoming soldiers, but also shaping the nature of concepts such as masculinity and femininity. Could you kind of talk a bit about that?
Sure. One of the things that drew me in early on to this project was reportage that came out of the surrender scene at the end of World War One, when the Schutztruppe commander of operations during the East African campaign, Paul von Lettow-Vorbeck, surrendered his army to the British in northern Rhodesia in late November of 1918. And the descriptions of that scene included these really colorful observations about the assemblage of people who were present at that surrender. And among them were women and children who were, who had obviously been along on the campaign, and who seemed to be very much a part of what Lettow-Vorbeck had been doing for the last couple of years of the war. So the presence of women was clear to me, and what was less clear was who they were, or why they were there, who they were, and why it was that the that German colonial officers permitted that kind of arrangement. I mean, when you think about modern armies operating in the field, you don't typically think of family members or, women and children being there on the scene. And that just kind of made me begin to look for evidence of, who these women were, in the same way that I was looking for evidence of who the askari were. People will not be surprised to hear that it's difficult to find good information or detailed information about who the women were, although there are glimpses, of course, that some of them were captives who were incorporated into households. Some of them were brought with soldiers into the army. So Sudanese troops brought their families with them right from the beginning, from the formation of the Schutztruppe in 1889, 1890. What became clear to me later in the research was that these women were actually what enabled the askari to make claims to being men of means and men of status, because a boy could not be a man, or a young man could not be an adult male, a man, until he had formed his own household, and that is kind of a fundamental marker of household a fundamental marker of respectability in many African cultures, that, you know, you have to demonstrate your manhood by having a family, and preferably a sizable family. So women were a part and parcel of that. They also clearly were part of the Schutztruppe's logic of building a cheap labor force. Women were the ones who did a lot of the kind of support work that in modern armies is done by a full-on logistical outfit. Women did the cleaning and the cooking and nursing and carrying equipment and setting up camps at the end of the day when soldiers were on the march and all sorts of things like that. So there's a way in which the domestic labor of the Askari's households were also the basis of the army's labor pool. And yes, and then of course there's the question of how one demonstrates one's masculinity. It has to be in conjunction with some sort of understanding of what constitutes femininity. And here I think there's probably a lot more work to be done in terms of understanding Askari women's femininity and what they were bringing to the table in terms of their contributions to shaping the gendered norms of the colonial army. But certainly it's important to note that any kind of masculinity that was built among Askari in East Africa was always in conversation with notions of femininity. There's one example in my book that I can think of right now, where, you know, Askari were working alongside other men, porters and auxiliaries and such. And one can easily imagine that the Askari were also building their sense of masculinity off of differentiating themselves from the other men who were around them. And certainly the porters would have been in a feminized position vis-a-vis the Askari because of the work that they did, which was carrying goods, which in kind of an Askari gendered world would have looked more like what women were doing in these columns. You know, carrying goods and carrying equipment was women's work to the Askari, right? So there are these really important ways in which the columns themselves were represented, these differentiated gender roles that encompassed a continuum of gendered identities from the feminine to the masculine.
We're getting near the end of our planned hour. So I just have two more questions. After the German defeat in World War I, the Askaris disbanded. Is that correct? And what happened to them after the dismantling of the Schutztruppe?
Here again, I think there's a lot more work to be done, and not something that I ended up spending a lot of time doing myself. But yes, they were interned for a while by the British. They were put in internment camps where many of them died of the flu. There was, of course, a rampant influenza epidemic that had a global impact. East Africa was a part of that, and many Askari succumbed to the illness in these camps. After they were released from the camps, they were ordered to disperse, more or less to go back to where they came from, which, again, this has lots of resonances for, contemporary U.S. military too, right? That where one comes from is a complicated question. Does it mean you go back to the last your last station? Does it mean that you go back to where you actually came from, you know, where you grew up? So it's unclear the extent to which Askari returned to whatever their homelands were, if you will. What does seem to emerge in the sources is that some of them ended up going back to the places where they had last lived in their military lives, their stations. And some enclaves of Ex-Askari seem to form and then and remained kind of visible communities into the British colonial period. But there really hasn't been much research done on them. And what emerges from my sort of brief engagement with this topic is that they dispersed, and it's very difficult to trace what happened to them as a collective. We get sort of these glimpses of them in places. We have a couple of discrete life histories that show, for example, one soldier who was actually a gun boy during World War I, eventually making his way to Germany and becoming an entertainer in the film industry. And he ended up dying in a concentration camp during World War II because of Nazi race laws, essentially. But, you know, so we get these glimpses of Askari lives after the war, but there's not been a good kind of project yet that has assembled all of that into a real argument about what happened to them. It would require a different kind of research. It would require actually going and talking to descendants of the Askari and trying to get at, you know, those lost histories that mm-hmm. way. And that, to my knowledge, has not been done yet. But it would be a great project for someone.
I totally agree. And it kind of leads to my last observation and why I think this book is bigger than its subject, if you don't mind my saying so in that way, not in a pejorative sense. I'd like to read one of your last bits. If we better understand how diverse incentives and coercions are conceived and used by states and others to assemble armies to fight for them, we might also develop more sophisticated ways of thinking about soldiers and veterans beyond the heroic platitudes that tend to disavow their everyday realities. So your book sort of implies different ways of thinking. Can you just, off the top of your head, suggest how your book can help us to think in new and more constructive ways about veterans and what their experiences have been and how they've affected our lives?
Well, I think the most important kind of realization for me was the way in which veterans, the way in which the Askari were so tightly tied to the fate of the German colonial regime. And part of the reason that we don't know much about what happened to them after World War I is that the Germans lost the war and, you know, they lost all their colonies. And so the German officers who had acted as the Askari's patrons could no longer protect them, could no longer ensure that they would be an important or visible part of the post German colonial landscape. And, you know, the evidence suggests that many Askari fell into destitution because of that. So to me, the question then is about what a state's obligation is to these kinds of people who have done their work of securing the states, you know, present day parlance, we'd say national security, right? The people who are responsible for the ins and outs of making people feel better about living in a state where there are threats, where there seem to be threats all around. You know, what is owed to the people who do that work? And so that's one kind of, that's one part of it. But there also has to be, I think, a much more direct conversation about what we expect these people to do, and which people, right? I mean, it's if you look back at the U.S.'s 20th century history, you certainly see evidence of military, our military, drawing on particular kinds of populations to fill its ranks, even though ostensibly we have a volunteer military. And the way it does that is by incentivizing joining the military. You get benefits. You get to go to college. You get breaks on mortgages. If you stay in long enough, you get a pension. Used to be the case that you got pretty comprehensive health care. That has changed. But so there are all these ways in which promises are made to veterans, to soldiers, about what will happen to them after they finish their service and become veterans. And I think, you know, most veterans believed in those things when they were recruited. They often become disappointed in the aftermath when they find that the, you know, the relationship dissipates a bit once they're out of service. So I think, you know, those were kind of the sets of questions that were in my mind as I was thinking about what the larger impact of my work could be. That in understanding the development of this very tight relationship between colonial officers and African troops, what we're looking at is a kind of a microcosmic representation of what is in play with many militaries that claim to be volunteer and claim to have all these kinds of objectives for taking care of the people who do this work, but which in the end often are quite content to use them and throw them away. A consequence of that is that it's not just that these soldiers are often left on their own and left to make their way in a world that doesn't fully understand them. It's also that communities have to figure out ways to live with them, right? That veterans who return after combat to families and communities are often not well equipped to deal with the realities of their new lives, and what is the state or patron's role in managing that? I think it's an open question that that certainly many of us are thinking about these days with the kind of stories that we've heard about veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and the impact that they have had on their communities in some very profoundly negative ways in many cases, and then also the scandals around Veterans Administration and what the state owes to these people who've often sacrificed a tremendous amount.
Well, Professor Michelle Moyd, thank you so much. I think that's a wonderful way to end our conversation. As with so many great works of history, your book raises many profound questions, not just about the particular topic at hand, the Askari, during a relatively brief period of time, but about our place in society and what kind of ideal world we wish to construct and achieve. We've been talking with Professor Michelle Moyd about her book, Violent Intermediaries, African Soldiers, Conquest, and Everyday Colonialism in German East Africa. It's part of the New Histories of Africa series published by Ohio University Press. I really, really want to thank you for spending time with me, and I'm sure our listeners will really benefit from this program and your insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for this opportunity and for reading my book.